also a village, and it's a village it has been for 3.5 centuries now. And it's a village because it's a village of blood, because refugees have come to Soho.
Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
And welcome to Science Mixtape. My name is Kyle Major, and today we'll be talking about all things plasma. Mariam Babucha is a physicist at Imperial and uses plasma to study huge astronomical events in a lab on Earth. She's also involved with the Eurofusion project as an ambassador, so we'll be talking about fusion energy projects and basically solving the world's energy crisis. So welcome, Mariam.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
That's great. It's great for you to be here. So before we head into all things plasma, I've got a little brain teaser for everybody. So if you know the answer to this, get in contact with us on at Soho Radio over Twitter. And here it goes. How many cuts does it take to cut a cube into 9 identical smaller cubes? So puzzled faces around here, you know, in the studio. But one more time. So how many cuts does it take to cut a cube into 9 identical smaller cubes? So if you know, do tweet in. And while we all ponder that riddle, we're going to put on the first song Mariami's chosen. So what's the first song you've chosen?
So this is Stay by Kygo. This is a song that I always listen to in the lab. It gives me like some summer vibes, which I like, so I hope you enjoy it.
Great, so some good summer vibes on this wintry morning.
Stay, yeah, 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 stay. But I don't need you, and you should know that, baby.
Most of the universe is not solid, liquid, or gas. In fact, over 99% of the universe is plasma.
Well, so, I mean, that's amazing. I mean, you don't see plasmas around us, and thank you, Yasmin, for that fact, who's over on the producing desk today. Hello, how are
Hello,
you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Great. So, first off, Mariam, what is a plasma?
Yeah, so I just wanted to say, like, 99% of the universe is a plasma, but yet we don't see much of it in our everyday lives. I mean, some examples of a plasma are stuff like the sun, which we see pretty much every day, fire in, like, candles on a birthday cake. But plasma is the fourth state of matter. So we're used to seeing solids, liquids, and gases, and the fourth state is the plasma. So how do we get to that fourth state? Well, you start off with a solid. To get to a liquid, you heat up the solid. And then from the liquid to the gas, you heat that up. And then when we get to the gas stage, you can heat up the gas even further. And that's where you heat it up so much that atoms don't exist anymore. The electrons are taken away from their nuclei and you're left with something called a plasma. So that's like a soup of ions and electrons.
So it's still made of stuff. It's still made of like the same thing that gases and liquids are. This is atoms and with you know,
exactly.
their nucleuses with their electrons around them. But in a plasma that it's so hot or that it, everything's kind of blown apart.
Exactly. It's so extremely, extremely hot that the electrons can't stay bound to their nuclei. And so they just end up whizzing around each other.
So it does it behave like a gas or like a liquid or does it behave kind of differently?
It behaves completely differently. So when you put, say, like a magnet or huge magnetic fields next to a plasma, you'll see these charges, these electrons and ions just whizzing around in circles, whereas a gas doesn't do that because gas is made up of neutral atoms. So it behaves completely differently.
So the plasma itself is made up of these charged particles.
Exactly.
And so it responds to electric fields and magnetic fields, and that makes the particles whiz around.
Whiz around, exactly.
So I mean, if that's the case, then you said that something that's like a plasma is the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the sun not just, you know, whizzing around and stuff? Well, it looks quite stationary from where we are. Is that just how it looks? Or
I mean, so when you get close up to the sun, you will see all these things whizzing around, and you'll see it's the sun is a very violent place, but it's all held together with like gravitational forces. So you've got all this matter converging into each other because they're attracted to each other, right. And there's a lot of matter in there as well.
The sun's just so big that it holds itself together.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you're talking about plasmas in this thing, the sun, right? This is at the center of our solar system, but there are lots of other plasmas in space that are not quite of the same form. What other kind of plasmas do we see out there?
So you see stuff like clouds of plasma, and so that's like the starting point of stars. So you have these huge clouds of plasma, and they're the beginnings of stars forming. So some will gravitate towards each other, and then that's how a star forms.
So these are like big interstellar mediums, dust clouds.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I guess dust, but yeah. But they form a plasma as well, and they move mm-hmm. around according to these magnetic and gravitational electric forces. I know that your work at Imperial actually looks at trying to mimic them or simulate them.
Exactly.
But I presume your lab isn't big enough to put a whole solar system in it.
Of course, or
something that scale. So how do you go about beginning to try and do that?
So space is a huge space, and what we try and do is we try and get the experiments. So we do experiments on a small scale. So space is hard to kind of, you can't really go out there and take data from there. It's so far away. And things happen on a really large time scale. So lots of astrophysical scenarios happen across like so many billions of years. And so what we try and do is we scale it down. So we do experiments where it only takes a few, like a billionth of a second to happen, and we scale it down to, so our chamber is about maybe less than a meter wide, and we do experiments in that chamber. So the vacuum chamber is where all the exciting science happens. We scale down big astrophysical scenarios into small experiments, and what's cool about those experiments is we can manipulate them, we can change variables, and we can simulate what happens out in space.
So I mean, on space you're looking at these plasmas moving, and this happens over hundreds of years, thousand years, even longer, but it happens over a much bigger space. So you just scale everything down.
Down.
So you scale down the time it takes and the distance it's traveling, and in order to make. So what kind of things are you able to simulate?
So the stuff that happens on the machine that we work on, which is called Magpie, is we try and simulate stuff like astrophysical jets, which come out from black holes. We also simulate stuff like supernova explosions. So that's really, really cool because those are such exciting big events. And to be able to show those and do those in our experiments.
And they happen so rarely. We don't see them very much, right?
Exactly. So being able to do, say, we do a shot a day, an experiment a day, basically. Whereas in space, it's really hard to find those stuff happening. So I guess that's what's really nice about being in the lab and doing these experiments is we can recreate these amazing astrophysical scenarios and watch how they evolve.
So, I mean, how does Magpie, you said the machine's called, how does Magpie work? I mean, how do you generate these kind of conditions in the lab?
So Magpie is actually a huge lab, so it stretches across two floors. So Magpie has four huge capacitors, and those capacitors store electrical charge. So to give you a bit of feel for like the numbers, we charge up those capacitors to 65,000 volts. So in your main supply, it's only about 230-240 volts, but we charge them up to 65,000 volts. That's a lot of voltage.
Yeah, it's a lot of electricity.
Exactly. So then those, and there's four of them, so we charge them all up to the same voltage, and we basically allow all that charge to build up, and then we let it go all at once, and all that charge, all that electricity goes off in hundreds of a billionth of a second, and it passes through stuff as thin as my hair. So some of the experiments that I do is I use this thing called a cylindrical wire array. What that is basically wires which are arranged in like a cylinder, and they're as thin as your hair, and all this current, all this charge passes through those thin wires, and it basically makes them vaporize, and that's what turns into a plasma. So that's how we form the plasma.
Right. So you charge up these banks, and this is I'm guessing this is why you can only do one shot a day, because it takes so long to charge.
Up.
I mean, you think it takes long to charge your phone, but I can't imagine charging this experiment takes a day, right?
Yeah.
but you charge this huge voltage, and then all of the electricity gets flown through these very thin wires in a very short time, and that causes them to explode. And that explosion is enough to generate a plasma in the air, or do you have like a gas in there that you use to make that?
So we generally make these plasmas in a vacuum chamber, because we don't want anything sort of obstructing that plasma flow. We want it to be raw, just plasma in that.
So it's like space.
So the vacuum that we have is, I think, almost as good as space, if not better. So we allow the plasma to flow in that environment just as it would do in space.
So the plasma is formed by the material that the wires are made from.
Exactly.
And that's generated in that. So you then direct that with magnetic fields and electric fields and things to try and make it flow in a particular way, or do you just watch it as it goes?
So the experiments that I do, actually, we just watch it flow, because they produce their own magnetic fields, because we have charged particles, and when you have moving charged particles, they generate their own magnetic fields. And so it's kind of like a self-sustaining kind of reaction, because you've got these charged particles moving that produce magnetic fields, and then those magnetic fields influence the charged particles. So we just watch it flow.
So, yeah, so it kind of makes its own experiment in its way.
And it's really exciting when it happens. So when the capacitors charge up, there's a bit of suspense when we're about to fire. And then when it does eventually fire, you can hear like a big bang. And it's always such a cool thing. So we have to wear like ear protectors when we're working on Magpie. And I love it every time we do a shot.
Yeah, I actually work in the lab next to you at Imperial.
Do you hear
it? When the shot goes off, there's always lots of alarms and people shouting. It's quite exciting, and I'm doing a very different experiment, and it's quite interesting to be next door. What is going on next door?
Do your oscilloscopes catch any like signals? Because I know there's a few labs next door that do.
Yeah, on one of the experiments that's on our lab, they do actually. Your experiment is so big and that it actually affects the whole building.
Yeah, all the labs, exactly.
That's amazing. So actually, what we're going to do is look at trying to heat up something using a laser, which is something you've brought with you today.
Yeah.
So we're going to do a demonstration where we try and pop a balloon with a laser, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
But before we do that, we're going to have your next song, which is Ed Sheeran, Shape of You. Why have you chosen this?
So this recently came out, and I just love the beat of this. And I also listen to this in the lab all the time. So I really like upbeat music. So I hope you enjoy.
Club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where I go. Me and my friends sat at the table doing shots, tripping fast, and then we talk slow. And we come over and start up a conversation with just me, and trust me, I'll give it a chance. Now take my hand, stop it, and the man on the jukebox, and then we start to dance. And now I'm singing like, girl, you know I want your love. Your love was handmade for somebody like me.
They are made of charged particles. Plasmas are better carriers of electricity than copper wires.
All right, so that's why this experiment works, right?
Exactly.
The magnetic and electromagnetic fields are actually carrying the current that's causing the experiment to cool.
Exactly.
That's great. So we're going to try and do a little experiment here in the studio. And Mariam, what have you brought with you? Can you describe this contraption that you have?
Okay, so it's pretty big. So it's like a metre tall, about 15 centimetres wide, and we call it the Pop-O-Matic. So it was originally made by a postdoc at Imperial College, and what it is a balloon-popping laser. So it's a green laser that shines into a red balloon, and it pops it.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so it's what we're looking at is this kind of clear Perspex tube that's, like you said, a metre tall.
Mm-hmm.
And inside is all kind of lenses, and there's a little box and switches on top. So, I mean, let's give it a go.
It looks really sciencey.
It's very convincing. And we'll put a picture up on Twitter so you can have a look at how the experiment's going. So let's go. What are we going to do first?
So the first thing that you actually do is you get this switch and you turn the
key. We need a balloon, right?
Yes, exactly. So what you do with the balloon is you have to slot it into the bottom of the pop-o-matic.
Okay, so you go ahead and do that. So there's a kind of little slot on the side, and what Miriam's doing is kind of crouching down and sticking the balloon through this slot and then blowing it up inside the experiment here. And I'm guessing that's just so that there's a lot of interlocks and safety, because this is actually quite a powerful laser. So right now she's kind of sticking through. And now, the next thing, I guess, is to just fire the thing up. So we're turning a key and pressing the button to try and initiate it, and and nothing happens. Brilliant. Okay, right. So that's what happens on live radio. It seems like our experiment has failed somewhat.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Hey, that's science, right? There's a it doesn't work first time, right? That's mm-hmm. that's why we do research. So, right, so what would have happened had it worked?
So basically, what would happen is I blow up the balloon. The laser actually passes through a series of lenses. So the first lens is like a microscope lens, and that expands the beam. So you can think of like a laser pointer. It has a really, really small point. What the microscope lens does is it expands the beam. It passes then through a lens, just like those that wear glasses. So the same, it's just a piece of glass. It then passes through another lens, and then what that does is it collects all the light into one space, into one point. And if you put the balloon at that point, all that laser energy is going onto the balloon, and it burns, it basically melts through the rubber, and that's what causes it to pop. So that's what we would have heard.
All right, yeah. So but it's amazing that there's enough energy just in the light to make the balloon pop. You know, I imagine there's a lot of energy if I, you know, actually physically poke it with a needle or I burn it with a lighter, but it's amazing that it's confined just in the lasers.
Exactly. And so that's where the lenses come in. It's like you have all these light like photons, or this light pieces, packets of energy, and they focus onto a point, and if you have enough of them hitting a small space, then they can become really, really powerful.
So actually, lasers, if you get enough of them, they're actually powerful enough to generate a plasma, right? And mm-hmm. and that's done in some experiments. How do they do that?
So places like NIF, which is the National Ignition Facility up in California in America, they actually use 192, I think it is, beams to focus, and they focus all those beams, all that energy, onto a small pellet of like deuterium and tritium fuel.
So deuterium is hydrogen, right?
It's basically kind of like a different type of hydrogen, so it just has another neutron. So hydrogen is like a proton, and then deuterium is just a neutron and a proton.
And that's the stuff that's in heavy water, right? So when you hear about these reactors, that they're generating this water which has deuterium on it.
Exactly, and that's why it's such a nice fuel, because it's so abundant. You can just find it in seawater.
It's just water.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So you take this thing, this pellet, which is a frozen pellet of hydrogen, and then you shine these lasers on it, and that actually initiates fusion.
Yeah,
cool. So you're actually the Eurofusion ambassador, so we're gonna talk about fusion in a little bit, but first off we're gonna have your third song.
Mm-hmm.
Which is Sean Paul featuring Dua Lipa. Why did you choose this one?
So when I was younger, during my teenage years, I always used to listen to Sean Paul. So I think I've still got that, and I wanted to add that into the mix just to get a bit of those vibes in.
Brilliant.
Feel your eyes, they all over me. Don't be shy, take control of me. Get the vibe, it's gonna be lit tonight.
Baby girl, you give me 10 ton of fatness, give me some of that. Thinks with the badness, look how she at. Shape like a death, but I'm not just that. It's a good piece of mental sand that they cap. A piece of game, I'm in love how you chat. Watching every step of the paper, the way you got. Staying in my brain, memory not detached. Mainly my aim is to give you this love. If not, dig the way you move. Let me acknowledge the way you do. Then I would not lie, baby.
Some fusion experiments generate temperatures of hundreds of millions of degrees, 10 times the heat inside the sun.
That's hot. That's very hot. So, as I mentioned before, you're the Eurofusion ambassador. What does that involve? What's this?
I'm actually like the young face of fusion is what the real title is.
Oh, wow. We have the young face of fusion.
It was like a huge project by the Eurofusion, which is a consortium for the development of fusion energy. And what they were doing was they have a magazine called Fusion in Europe, and they wanted about 20 students to write articles about relating to fusion, and I got chosen. So I was spotted on Twitter, actually. So I'm kind of thankful for Twitter, I guess. And she said, because I had written an article about sort of fusion before, and that's how I got chosen. And then from there, I wrote an article for the most recent Fusion in Europe magazine. And yeah, so I guess I got to go up to JET, which is a tokamak up in Oxford, and I got to interview the CEO of the UK Atomic Energy Authority, which was kind of impressive.
So we got the JET, tokamak, fusion.
Yeah, sorry.
First off, I mean, what is fusion?
So fusion is the process that powers our sun. So what happens is we have small nuclei that fuse together to make a larger nuclei. And so for instance, we have stuff like deuterium, which is a neutron and a proton. And then you have stuff like tritium, which is two neutrons and a proton, and they fuse together to produce a helium nucleus, as well as giving off some energy. So that's the basic fusion process.
So these are the nuclei of atoms,
exactly,
physically fusing together to form new atoms, basically. And mm-hmm. and this is the process that happens in our sun, right? This is why we have, you know, life on Earth, all the energy that's coming from it. So it's a very energetic energetic event.
Yeah.
And what fusion is looking at, or these fusion energy works, is to try and harness that power.
Energy.
So how are they going about doing that? How do you start?
So there's two main processes two main methods that you can do. So one is to use really high power lasers, and the other one is to use basically just huge magnets or huge magnetic fields. So the first one is called inertial confinement fusion. So that's using really, really high power lasers, and they focus all those lasers to a point, like I said before, onto a pellet of fuel.
Yeah, this is what we were talking about earlier with the lasers focusing down.
And so they use that to focus down on the fuel, and that initiates the fusion, because that's heating up that fuel to really, really extremely high temperatures, hotter than the interior of the sun. And then that produces the plasma, and that initiates the fusion reaction. The second method is magnetic confinement fusion, or I like to call it as magnetic bottles. So you can think of it as, think of like a slinky, and you turn it back on itself, and then that's like the magnets. So if you put your hand sort of inside the inner ring of the slinky, that's where the plasma goes. And you use those magnets, because magnets, as we said before, magnetic fields influence plasmas. And so we use that to confine the plasma. And then we can like inject other particles inside that sort of donut-shaped machine, and that heats up the plasma, and that's how we initiate the fusion.
And so this donut-shaped machine, this is this tokamak,
exactly,
and that's just the shape of the
So that's like a Russian acronym for the shape of this donut-shaped machine.
And so there's lots of magnetic coils, and you inject in your plasma, or gas first, and then you heat it up,
mm-hmm.
and that then turns into a plasma, and then the plasma is directed by the magnetic field
around.
To kind of around and around and around, and you just keep heating it up and keep heating it up, and eventually, hopefully, you get fusion.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, once you get fusion, what do you do with it? How do you... Because surely, does it not just explode, or?
So with the sort of like magnetic bottles, the tokamaks, you use those magnetic fields to confine the plasma. So we keep all the plasma in one place, and the energy is actually given off as either like gamma rays or x-rays, and we try and extract the energy through neutrons as well, because neutrons are also given off. And then with the laser... I guess it just kind of goes out in all directions.
Oh, so you heat up the gas, and then at some point the fusion is the thing that's actually heating it, and then you can use that heat to generate power in the same way that we do for normal power stations or for conventional nuclear power stations.
Exactly.
Right?
But the good thing about fusion, or why it's so ideal, is that it produces no pollution, so no carbon dioxide emissions. There's no long-lived radioactive waste. And like we said before, we can use like deuterium, which is found in seawater. So the fuel is low cost and abundant. So that's what makes it so ideal. And that's why we want it to make it happen.
So why hasn't it happened yet? Why is it so difficult?
I guess there's so many challenges. I mean, you're basically creating a small star on Earth. And so basically you're having like a mini sun on Earth. That sounds insane.
Yeah, it does sound a little bit insane, yeah.
There's a lot of challenges. So with the tokamaks, you have to have really high magnetic fields. I mean, we're trying to confine something basically as huge as the sun in something really small. And we have to have high enough magnetic fields. And we also have to make sure that the plasma doesn't hit the outer surfaces and melt our machine. I mean, that would be terrible.
So even if the plasma kind of wobbles a little bit, then it's a very, very hot thing. So it touching the outside, if it's not properly confined, it can put a hole in your tokamak, basically.
Yeah, of course. But also, if it starts hitting the sides, it cools down. And if we cool down our plasma, there's no more fusion. So that's a bad thing.
So what's the status of experiments at the moment? Have people made it? Or you know, I'm assuming fusion's been achieved inside these experiments, but obviously not at a level where it can produce power. So where are we at the moment?
So I guess we'll start off with who's actually doing fusion experiments. So in the UK, if we keep it close to home, in Oxford and Culham, at the Culham Centre for Fusion Energy, it is currently the world's largest and most powerful tokamak.
I heard that was currently the hottest at some points. It's for very short periods of time, mm-hmm. It's the hottest place in the known universe.
Of course, yeah.
Just outside Reading. Interesting.
So they do fusion experiments there, and they're hoping to actually move on to ITER, which is in the south of France, build a bigger machine. It's just so cool.
And so this ITER is being built in the south of France, but it's a collaboration for all across Europe, right? It's like a big project, kind of like the LHC at CERN. It's a huge collaboration, mm-hmm. So lots of people are involved, right?
Mm-hmm.
So their plan is to just go a little bit bigger, and hopefully that will work, or are there other changes that they're making?
I guess the plan is to make it a little bit bigger.
When it gets bigger, it gets more efficient, and it's more like you're more likely to be able to have this fusion that's sustained, and then you can actually extract energy out of it.
But also that means a lot of engineering problems as well, because you have to build bigger magnets and everything is just scaled up.
So there's still a lot of problems but to overcome before we can actually have fusion in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. So let's have your next song. This is Nicky Jam. Why did you choose this one?
So this is a Spanish tune, actually. And I guess I like the beats and I like the vibes it gives off. And so I like listening to this in the lab.
Here we go. Good vibes.
¿Cómo tú te llamas? Yo no sé de dónde llegaste ni pregunté. Lo único que sé es que quiero con usted quedarme contigo hasta el amanecer. ¿Cómo tú te llamas? Yo no sé de dónde llegaste ni pregunté.
The first successful man-made fusion device to achieve ignition was a thermonuclear device called Ivy Mike.
News.
Earwax inspiration for new cleaning compounds.
X-ray laser gets first real-time snapshots of a chemical flipping a biological switch.
Debate heats up over claims that hot water sometimes freezes faster than cold.
Hydrogen forms hydrogen clusters.
Urine is not sterile and neither is the rest of you.
Okay, wow. So first I want to know about this laser switching switches. What's this going about?
So in America, in California, there's a huge X-ray laser and it's called LCLS. And what they do is because it's an X-ray, that's a really short wavelength. So we can look at really, really small stuff. So they use the X-ray laser to look at chemical reactions, and then you can make a video out of it, which is really cool.
Measure a smaller thing.
Exactly. So then with visible light, you're only really limited to certain things that you can see. But now we're going into really smaller wavelengths, like X-rays, and you can see even smaller stuff, which is like chemical reactions.
Wow, so this is an individual chemical reaction. Atoms...
Moving
exactly. Together and doing interaction.
Yeah,
wow,
it's amazing.
So, what kind of timescales? This must be really short, right?
Really, really, really short. I mean, you can think about your metabolism and stuff. You need these atoms to move, I guess, quickly enough to do these chemical reactions.
So that's that must that's less than nanoseconds. These are these are incredibly quick.
Yeah, and that's why you need the laser. So you need pulses of laser, so small bursts of laser light, so that you can take really quick images. And then we put those images together to make a movie.
So you need short wavelengths, but this thing also happens very quickly. So you need very short times.
Exactly.
You can only look. You can only look at something if you use something that's a shorter timescale
than what's actually happening.
That's what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. So what? There's this effect for water cooling down.
Oh yeah,
faster if it's hotter. That doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's completely illogical. You'd always assume that the colder the water was, it would freeze faster. But due to the nature of hydrogen bonds, which are the bonds that stick different water molecules together, that actually might not be the case. And what's interesting is this debate, whether it's cold water that freezes faster or hot water that freezes faster, goes all the way back to Aristotle, who apparently observed hot water freezing more quickly. And also then in the 60s, a Tanzanian student noticed that ice cream went colder if it had been left out in the sun all day. So the more melted it was, the quicker it was to refreeze. Mm-hmm. So basically, it might be to do with the fact that as you heat water up, the weak hydrogen bonds, so all the weak bonds between all the water molecules, break down so that only the strong ones remain, and they form a structure that isn't dissimilar to the crystalline structure of water, of free frozen water.
Right.
So it's sort of, it's already in the right shape.
It's when you kind put of like it in a, the... like a pre-crystalline liquid sort of.
Yeah, kind of. So, but then again, there's people who think the opposite and the debate rages on.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So I think, is it called the Mpemba?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to say that correctly, but that's named after the Tanzanian students.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Yes. And this has been going on for a long time. Back when I was in the Stone Age, when I was doing my degree, there was a project that was actually just cooling down water to see if we could actually learn something about that. So even, you know, recently it's still being studied.
Yeah, because for obvious reasons, it's quite interesting to think that the opposite of your conception of water is true.
Well, so yeah, nature frequently confounds us, but it's also the inspiration for new things. I've read that people are trying to use earwax as an inspiration for cleaning compounds. So
tell us more.
It seems weird, right? But actually, earwax is pretty efficient at cleaning out your ears. You generate this kind of sticky, mucousy substance, and then after a while, all of the dirt and things falls out of your ears as there's this lump of solid stuff. And so what these scientists were looking at is trying to see, like, how does this happen? And eventually they found that it's just the material itself that can cause this. The idea is that this kind of, this wax, this goo, coats hairs and things inside of your ears. But then when the dust gets mixed with it, it slowly turns from being a goo into more of a kind of, dry, crumbly paste. And then the act of chewing is actually enough to dislodge that paste from inside your ears, and all of the dirt just falls out. And so there's a guy, David Hugh, who was doing some research at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, where he had flour and a big gob of pig's earwax. And the idea is he just slowly mixes in the flour with the earwax, and it goes from this sticky, gooey substance to like a dry, cumbly one, and then just falls away.
Cool.
So people are looking at this for inspiration for things like air filtration systems and how you can clean the dust out of air just using this reusable kind of substance, which I thought was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So earwax is, gross, but apparently urine's not sterile as we thought. It's a bit gross as well.
Well, I think we're all a little bit gross, really. Yeah, I think there's a misconception that urine is sterile, and that if you have a cut and you don't have access to something useful to clean that cut, it's you can pee on it and or get someone else to, I guess, and
right.
That would be, and that's that's really going to clean you properly. But unfortunately, it's just a bit of a misconception. It's been pretty much conclusively proven that even in people who have completely healthy bladders, you've got bacteria in your urine, and like you do everywhere in your body, on your skin.
Yeah, well, I was always told urine's sterile, don't worry about it, it's fine.
You get told that, and you get told, I don't know, was it Romans who would wash their clothes with it or something like that. But it may have low levels of bacteria compared with other parts of your body, but it's still not sterile, so I wouldn't use it to clean anything. But earwax, you can use for anything.
Earwax you can use, yeah, that's fine. Don't worry, I'm sure that's full of bacteria and horrible. So the only other thing I read this week, which is this cool thing that they've looked into hydrogen forming new kind of molecules. This idea is that if you cool hydrogen down and then irradiate it with ions, you ionize some of the hydrogen, and they all coalesce together into a very defined geometry. So this is many hydrogen atoms that come together and they form an icosahedron, like a 3D shape, a regular 3D shape with 12 vertices and 12 molecules of hydrogen around there. So this is this amazing thing that the groups were up to 60 molecules, and this is just a completely new shape that hydrogen is forming when you cool things down and irradiate it in this way, which I thought was really interesting. And
is it useful for anything, that shape?
So they think that maybe these clusters might form naturally in atmospheres in space, but in maybe other giant planets where the atmosphere is much colder, and so you do get these kind of similar formations when things are very cold. So maybe that gives us some insight into the atmospheres of other planets.
That's really cool.
In our own solar system, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So that's science news for today. So we're going to have your fifth song, Riam, which is Neo. Why did you choose this one?
So this one was from my teenage years, and I thought I'd add that to the mix just to get those old school vibes back.
Off in this place, and she shines just like a star, and I swear I know her face, I just don't know who you are. Turn the music up in here, I still hear her loud and clear, like she's right there in my
A large power station generating 1,500 megawatts per hour of electricity would consume less than 1 kilogram of fuel a day. Coal plants use 18,000 tons per day.
Wow, so that's quite a big saving in energy. That's why we want to drive towards this fusion. So we're nearly out of time here, but we're going to have a chance to go back to our brain teaser, which was, how many cuts do you need to make to cut a cube into 9 smaller cubes? And so have we had any responses on Twitter, Yasmin?
Yeah, we've had a couple of guesses. Vivian Harris guessed that you would need 4 cuts to a cube. I can see you think, which means, but I don't think it would make perfect cubes. So
right. And so what do you guys think in the studio?
So you have to make exactly 9.
You have to make exactly 9.
Ooh. Yeah.
I can only really think of like 6 cuts. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But that was just because it's...
It is 6 cuts. That's the right answer. Congratulations. Now, the way to think about this is actually, if you think about the middle cube in the middle of your original cube, how many cuts do you need to make that cube? Well, you have to make 1 cut on every face.
Oh.
And so that cube has 6 faces, so you need to make 6 cuts.
I'm going to say that's exactly what I was thinking.
So, Miriam, you've been quite involved with promoting women in physics. What kind of stuff are you doing at the moment to try and promote?
So at Imperial, I am currently the undergraduate rep for the Women in Physics Society. So that's a community for all the women in physics at Imperial. So it's a place for them to share their stories, inspire each other, and make sure that everyone's supported, so that they can keep going along their career in academia.
Yes, I mean, there are... undeniably fewer women in science and engineering and maths. I'm wondering what you think. What do you think the root causes are? Like, why is this happening? Does it just exist, or is there something that we can do?
I guess there's a few factors that add up to this. So one of them, I guess, is a lack of female role models. So I remember when I was at school during my A-levels, I didn't know any female physicists. I mean, all I could think about was Einstein or Brian Cox, and I couldn't put a female name to a physicist. So I guess that was kind of a way for me, like, I could think that maybe this wasn't a career for me because there was no other females that I could look up to. So I guess maybe other females feel the same, or other girls in the classroom feel the same way, is that they can't look up to someone that's doing it.
Yeah, and so we can change that by just, you know, having more role models and showing that you know, women are just as good scientists.
Exactly. So I'm so up for just promoting what you do. And that's what I do, is I go back into schools and I do talks and hopefully inspire the younger generation to follow in my footsteps and take on physics, because it's definitely not a guy subject. Anyone can do it.
Yeah. And there's been some controversy recently about, you know, women only crying and falling in love in labs, to which there was some hilarious backlashes on Twitter. I found some of that.
Who
great.
Was it who said that? I can't remember.
I'm really off the top of my head. I absolutely cannot remember.
I think it was like Sir Hunt or
yeah,
someone.
Yeah, someone very prominent. Yeah.
Yeah.
But rightly forgotten, I think. But I mean, do you think that things like that, like, and the backlash is actually changing things? People are becoming more aware of it, and
yeah, because it went crazy on Twitter at that time, and I think it was just bringing awareness to it, to that it is an issue, and that girls do face that kind of like stereotype that people put on them, and I think it's really a negative thing. But when it was when people were backlashing onto that, and I think it was like a huge kind of like support system, and I guess other females or other girls were thinking, okay, no, this we're not criers in the lab, like this isn't a thing. So yeah,
I mean, it's brilliant, and it's so good that things are changing, and thank you for the work you're doing in promoting that. We're sadly at the end of our show, but Miriam, thank you so much for coming, and I hope to have you back someday.
No, thank you for having me. This was so much fun. I really hope to do it again.
Great. So I've been Kyle Major, and we've had Yasmin on the producing desk.
Yes, bye.
Bye-bye, and we'll just play us out. We'll have your final song, which is Christopher and Matoma, which I haven't heard of.
It's a good summer vibe tune, so I hope you like that. I know it's winter, but
no, we like summer. Let's play out on that. This is Take Me Back by Christopher and Matoma.
If I could go back in time, give you every piece of my heart, I promise, girl, I'd give you all of my life.